is Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. Through the grace of God, the 12 steps and sponsorship, I've been sober since June 2nd of 1988. For that, I'm grateful. I always had so many neighbors. But I was one of those guys, a neighbor from hell. So they're happy I'm sober. I got a home group. It's, now you'll like this name. It is the Laguna East Step Study Meeting in Philadelphia. We actually had a guy who couldn't stay sober. He went out west, got sober in Southern California, and came back and started the Laguna East Step Study. We meet at the basement of Sacred Heart Church at Moyamensing and Tasker on Wednesday afternoons at 4:30 in the afternoon. So if you ever, it's a great time to have a meeting too. So if you're ever in the neighborhood, please stop by. We'd love to have you. I'd like to thank Jack for inviting me to participate. A lot of guys, a lot of these guys I've met before. I know there's a group from Lake Murray are here. That's pretty cool to see you guys again. So, but it's always a privilege to participate in Alcoholics Anonymous because towards the end of my drinking, I was only invited to leave. I wasn't invited anywhere else. I was invited to leave. And I'm actually looking forward to our drive back to the airport. You know, Jay, Bill, myself, and Robert. So it's just good stuff. So I have about 45 minutes or so to share in a general way what my life was like as an active alcoholic, what happened to me, what my life is like today as an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I was born and raised in a very blue-collar ethnic neighborhood in Philadelphia. Both sets of my grandparents immigrated from Ireland. They landed in Philadelphia around in the 1920s. And once the boat landed there, that was it. They weren't moving. And so that's where I am. I'm one of eight. My mother was pregnant for 11 years. And I know you guys, she was though. I have a sister who's 11 months older than me. I am 11 months older than my next sister. You know, none of this Irish twins. This is Irish octuplets. Yeah. And my dad's parents lived around the corner from us, and their basement was finished as into a bar, and that's where all the family functions are held, the graduations, the christenings. You know, there was always a party. My father was one of 12. My mother from a much smaller family. She was one of 11. So that we were always... And we weren't the biggest family on the block. That was not unusual. There was no booze in all my house. My father did not drink. My father never had a drink. He only once, the night before I left for basic training, my dad and I, he took me out to dinner, and he ordered two beers, and I couldn't drink the beer. First of all, I wanted to get back to the neighborhood because my friends were having a party for me. But also, I felt uncomfortable. And I now realize, years later, I realize that was my dad's attempt to try to bond with me. But I just couldn't do it. So he never drank. My mother had a long history of mental illness and abuse of prescription medication. And we now know that some of that mental illness was postpartum depression, which was not diagnosed in the 50s and 60s. That's when my siblings were born. So growing up in my neighborhood, it's probably the same stories down here. You know, you hang on the corner and you drink. You know, my drinking really took off. I only drank on the weekends. Well, let me back up. My very first time I had a drink, I did not get drunk, but I remember it was Ballantine beer. And I would remember my grandparents, Ballantine used to sponsor the Phillies. And my father would take me up to Connie Mack Stadium, and they had this old scoreboard in right center field with their logo, the three interlocking circles. And I was running around the basement bar polishing off the half empties or the half fulls. It depends on your perception. And I remember my uncles, hey, look at him, look at Bobby. But I never felt a part of. And that's pretty tough to do when you have 10 people living in a small three-bedroom row home. But I never felt a part of, and that would be true in early recovery. Most of the kids in my neighborhood went to the local diocesan high school. My parents, being children of immigrants, knew that education was important to succeed. So they sent me to this private Jesuit high school. And right away, I felt kind of different because most of the kids who went to the school were from affluent families from the suburbs. Just me and a couple other dirtballs in the neighborhood. And we used to walk to the school, which right away these kids in the suburbs were intimidated by us because it was in a pretty gritty area. And we did things, you know, as these kids were getting dropped off by their parents in their luxury automobiles, me and the guys from the neighborhood were inside robbing their lockers. Now, I knew that was wrong. I knew that by the values instilled in me by the nuns as a kid and by my parents, but the need for me to be accepted by you outweighed anything else. And I'm compromising values right at an early age, you know, and this is long before I had a drink. And one of my nicknames was Crazy Coyle. And I would do things in my gut that was really, I knew it was wrong, but I did it anyway because I didn't want to disappoint you. And we did other things. We saw football pools. And if you hit, we wouldn't pay off. And they kept coming back. We would sell you, if you want to buy a particular substance, we would sell you a substitute substance. And you kept coming back. I mean, we went through more oregano than a pizzeria, but we thought we were gangsters. We were idiots, you know. And when it came time to graduate from the prep, I really had no desire to further my education, and I knew that would cause some problems in my home, you know. And I don't like to catch hell. Love to create it, don't like to catch it. So my options are limited. I'm 17. I have no money, no skills. What do I do? I'll join the service. Really wasn't a bright move, not to talk politics. I'll set the scene real quick, though. Vietnam had just ended. This is in the 70s. The military is not popular. Jimmy Carter is the president. So, but I enlist. And I go through all my training. I get sent overseas. And that's when my drinking really took off. I never messed around with other substances, never smoked a joint. In high school, I only drank on the weekends, and there was a reason for that, because I wasn't allowed out on school nights. But if I was allowed out on school nights, I'm sure I would have drank then too, but it was just weekends, you know. And so after I was deployed, I was there, you know, it was just under a month, you know, 3 weeks or so. And there was an incident in which three of my closest friends got killed. And I didn't know how to handle that. Because in my family, we don't talk about nothing, you know. The house could be on fire and you could be standing outside. How's it going? Everything's all right, you know. You don't tell people anything. And that's not a shot at my folks. That's just the way it was. And once you moved out of the house, whether you went to get married or moved away, went to school, you were no longer privy to the secrets of the family. Everything stayed within the walls in the house and everything stayed inside. And when my friends got killed, and I knew there was help extended to me, but I didn't want to hear it. And I just use it as an excuse to drink to numb the pain. Now, when I was on duty, I was squared away. Off duty, I was getting loaded. And I didn't distinguish myself, but I didn't get any jackpots either. I gave the bare minimum effort required to get by. And mediocrity was my goal, and I was okay with that. My enlistment was up. I came home. I enrolled in school. I went to St. Joe's. And it's still a small school, but back then we had maybe 3,000 kids tops, you know, 15, 20 kids in the classroom. And the same thing there, just as in the prep, not making the dean's list, but not doing poorly either, just doing enough to keep the heat off my back. Wound up taking a couple civil service exams for the city. I remember it was at the end of my spring semester, my freshman year, kid from the neighborhood called me. He said, "Bobby, the Phillies are playing tomorrow. One of those businessman specials, you know, mid-afternoon, mid-week game." He said, "You want to go?" I said, "Sure, I'll go. I'm not an active participant in the classroom. No one's going to miss me." So I cut class and went to the Phillies game. Now, by this time, they had moved. They were playing at the Vet Stadium down in South Philadelphia. And it was an unusually warm day. It was in May. And I'm at the top of that 700 level drinking that cheap, watered-down beer. And the sun's beating down on me. And I'm getting kind of trash. And I told the guys I was with, I said, "You know what?" I said, "I'm going down the field and meet one of the players." And they said, "Okay, Bobby." And they kind of shrugged me off. Because another nickname I had was Bullshit Bob. I lied about everything. I lied when I was better suited to tell the truth. I lied about my ethnic heritage. Now, one look at me, right? I'm as Irish as Patty's pig. I mean, you can't deny that. But we had a lot of social clubs in my neighborhood, and really, they're nothing but speakeasies, right? And one of them was the Yuki Club, the Ukrainian-American Social Club. And I'm in there one night drinking, and I don't know why. I wasn't carded. I wasn't questioned. I just volunteered to tell the bartender that my mother was Ukrainian. I was in there with my brother Brian a couple weeks later, and he comes in, and he says, "Here's Bobby the Yuki." My brother's head snapped around. I said, "What'd you tell this guy?" I said, no, I've never seen him before. And I know you can laugh, but the truth is that I had no sense of self. I didn't think you would like me for who I was, so I was constantly always reinventing myself, you know. Just, I couldn't distinguish reality from fantasy, you know. So, but at the Vet, they used to have these picnic areas in the left field and the right field corner. So I worked down the one of the picnic areas in left field. And before I knew it, I hurdled the fence and I'm running across the field. Now, the San Diego Padres were in town. And Dave Winfield was the right fielder for the Padres. Yeah, he was awesome, right? I go out and I shake his hand. I say, "Hey, Dave, how you doing?" And he looked at me and said, "Brother, what are you doing out here?" And he's a pretty big dude. I said, "Dave, I got to go now." And I start running towards the infield and I want to slide into second base. I don't know why. I just thought that'd be a pretty cool thing to do. But I was running towards the infield. There was more guards coming from the third base side, and I knew I couldn't do that. If I slid in a second, I'd get caught. So I turned around, and I slow trot towards first base, where there was more security coming. And I'm as close to the guards as I am to Al right now, and I'm walking to give myself up. But the last second, I deked the guy, and I ran out in the outfield. Now, I'm running around like a screwball. It seems like 10 minutes, but it's probably closer to 2 or 3, right? But the place is going nuts. These guards, these young, short, fat guys from South Philly, they're over tripping over each other. It looks like Keystone Cops. I'm in the best shape of my life. I just came home, right? And I'm joking and jiving. I got nowhere to go. The fence is 12 feet high. I'm drunk. I'm out of breath. I'm actually about to get sick. So I just stop in center field. I wait, and they come, and they take me off the field. Swear to God. Standing ovation from 37,000 people. The place was going nuts. They take me up to the bullpen, and Tug McGraw was in the bullpen for the Phillies, and the Tugger gave me the thumbs up. I like to think he was loaded because the Tugger, he had a reputation for knocking them back. Now, I knew I was going to get a beating from these guards, but I was okay with that because I figured by the time I get out of jail, I'd be back in the neighborhood. I could drink for free off this story for at least a week. Now, this may be a type of story I'd make up, bullshit Bob, but I had those four guys in the neighborhood. I figured by the time they'd bail me out, I'd be cool. So just as I was about to get my beating, a Philadelphia police lieutenant showed up. He said, "What's the matter with you?" He said, "Are you drunk? Are you high?" I said, "No, I'm just happy. I'm just happy to be here. Just was overseas, just got home. I'm just happy to be here." He said, "Well, you better get your happy ass out of the stadium." So not only did he save me from getting a beating, but he saved me from getting arrested, and that would be important because about 6 weeks later, one of those civil service exams kind of panned out, and I got hired by the Philadelphia Police Department. They were hiring anybody back then. Now, I tell that story for a couple different reasons. One, it's the only funny story I got. I wasn't a funny guy. I wasn't a lover. I wasn't an athlete. I was a lying, thieving, stinking, phone-down, violent drunk. And if I hung around you, you had something I wanted. I used and abused everybody I came in contact with. I was a creep in all areas of my life. Secondly, it's your true story. Four of those guys, two of them are now sober, now Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was so glad when the first one showed up. Because I know we don't lie from the podium, but I know you questioned me. But when he showed up, I said, thank God he can verify. But thirdly, and even more importantly, I was a blackout drinker. You know, and I never even knew what they were. I spent almost 6 months in various VA hospitals, and I remember the doctor came up to me and said, "Joe, do you have any blackouts?" I said, "Nope." "I must answer too quickly." He said, "Do you know what they are?" I said, "Nope." And once he described them, I said, "All the time. I just thought that was normal. Like, I would wake up, and I was telling guys early, like, for the city, Thursday was payday. Friday I'd wake up, I would have 3 quarters and, like, 4 crumpled singles on my dresser. Like, where did the money go? Where did I park my car? Who are you?" I mean, I didn't know nothing. I would remember the next day, I would, you know, catch up with the guys I was out with the night before, and they would tell me stories of the stunts that I pulled, and I would retell those stories like I had memory myself. Blackout drinker from the very first start. I spent the first part of my career in North Philadelphia, where I would see the ravages of alcoholism and drug addiction day in, day out. And at the end of the tour, I go out with guys at the squad and drink, you know. I saw things that on the job that bothered me, but I couldn't tell my coworkers that because I didn't want to be less than. And again, engaging in behaviors that I knew was wrong. You know, compromising values and principles, you know, the way I treated people, the way I spoke to people, because the need for me to be accepted by these guys outweighed anything else. And the handwriting was on the wall. I'm at work one day, my immediate supervisor pulled me off to the side. He said, "You know what, kid, you're smart. You're going to go places. That booze is going to mess you up, in one ear and out the other." I'm at a family function one night. My uncle, he was a boss in the job. He pulled me off to the side. He said, "Bobby, I'm hearing stories about you. You're going to get yourself in a jackpot. You better take it easy. Slow down." Several years later, on 2 separate occasions, I ran into my uncle and that supervisor in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized at that point that you're trying to 12-step me. And I went up to my uncle and said, "Yo, Wonk, how come you didn't tell me?" He just gave me one of them old-timer smiles and said, "Bobby, you just weren't ready yet." Which just goes to show you that all the drinking and all the nonsense that went with it were necessary for me to hit my bottom. And that's what had happened. I was 24 years old and was involved in an incident in which a 15-year-old kid lost his life, and it was a terrible situation that couldn't be avoided, and I used it as an excuse to crawl in a bottle, and that's what I would do for the next 3 years. I wound up getting sober when I was 27. Drinking took me to a lot of my nevers, and one of those was drinking on the job. I would never do this, but I wound up getting promoted, and I was doing this type of work, and I thought I needed to maintain some sort of illusion. But the fact is, I worked with men and women who did the exact same job that I did, and they served with integrity, and they didn't do the things I did. And then one night, because I was so impaired by my drinking, I was put in a position where I thought I needed to do other substances. I would never do this. This was like the red line. I did that. And my use of other substances is very short. It was about 15 months. But it brought me to my knees. And out of respect to the fifth tradition, that's all I need to talk about that stuff. So please feel free. Use your imagination. Let it run. Because whatever I did, I took off you anyway, you know, so it was ugly. It was just an ugly life. And I didn't think anybody would help me because I was such a creep. And really, I'm a creep in all areas of my life. I couldn't even get guys to go out with me towards the end of my drinking. They would make excuses. I got caught in the morning. I'm broke. I said, that's all right. I got you covered. Nah, that's all right, Bobby. No, thank you. You know, when you couldn't even buy guys to go out with you anymore, you know, that's how bad it was. It was Memorial Day weekend, 1988. Me and the guys that I worked with, we were in trouble. We go to the bar, get our story straight. One thing led to another. It just turned out to be another drinking nightmare. One of the guys I was with decided he needed to go home. God forbid, take care of some sort of family obligation. I decided I would give him a ride home. I didn't think I was as impaired as he was. I'm driving out this street, a narrow one-way street, the big stone wall on my left-hand side. Kid riding towards me on a bicycle, and I thought I'd play chicken with this kid. Didn't know why, I just thought it'd be funny to see this kid jump the curb and grab the wall. Unfortunately, we're turning in the same direction. I ran that kid over. As he lay bleeding on my hood of my car, I got out of my car with my nightstick and was going to beat this kid because I thought he was going to milk me or the city for an insurance claim. The guy that I was with prevented me from doing this. I took this kid off the hood of my car, threw it on the side of the street like a piece of trash. I drove back to the bar and made some sort of...
Can you talk, Bobby?
Yeah, sure. Okay. My name's Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. Sorry about that. So I drove back to the bar, made some sort of smart aleck remark. I continued on drinking. When I came to the next day, I realized I was in serious trouble, but I didn't think anyone would help me because I was such a creep. So what I did, I got a case of beer, a bottle of liquor, and some other substances, and I checked into a hotel with the intentions to consume all this stuff to build up the courage and my life. And 3 days later, I guess that's all I had the money for the room. They knocked on the door to get rid of me, you know. The booze is gone. The other stuff is gone. At this point, I'm suspended from my job. I no longer have access to my weapons, so I couldn't shoot myself. So I walked over to the window, and I opened up the window, and I was going to jump out the window of my life. And I opened up the window, and I was on the fifth floor. I remembered I was scared of heights. I made 23 jumps, so I never overcame my fear of heights. So I go in the bathroom, and I filled the bathtub with the water, and I had a blow dryer. I was going to pull the blow dryer into the tub to make it appear an accidental electrocution. But every time I would pull the blow dryer into the tub, it would come unplugged. I was about a foot and a half short on cord. And I got 1 foot, you know, trying to plug it in. And again, I you know, you can laugh, but it was pretty pathetic. It would be the last day that I would ever have a drink. I didn't realize that then. And I'm glad I didn't, because maybe I would have changed it around. And one of my favorite movies is, like, It's a Wonderful Life, you know. And who knows, you change one aspect and your life changes completely. So, but I got in my car, that was the only tool that I had left. I went through my neighborhood. I went to see where I went to grade school, the corner I hung on. I start up at the Falls Bridge. I come down the East River Drive, which is a winding road along the Schuylkill River, and I descend. I would end my life in an automobile accident. I mean, I handle jobs like this, head-on collisions at a certain rate of speed, especially if you're not belted in. You get ejected, you get struck by another vehicle. That does the trick. And by then, I just started crying. And I really didn't want to hurt an innocent. And that's what would have happened if I would have gone on oncoming traffic. But that's not me. I now know that was God interceding in my life right then. Because I don't care about anybody else. you know. But I still needed then my pain, so I decided I'll wrap myself around one of these trees. And I handle jobs like this, too. If you hit these trees just about right, you could split the vehicle in half. And again, if you're not belted, you get ejected. And then I just lost it. And at the end of the East River Drive, it's Boathouse Row, and I threw my car up on the sidewalk, and I just sobbed like a baby. And I reached into my glove box, where I always had an extra gun, and the gun wasn't there. But inside the glove box was my wallet, and inside the wallet, there was an article that I had clipped out of the Daily News about 3 weeks before. And the circumstances of that, I was sitting home from work one day, I'm reading this story, and at the end it had a series of questions. Alcohol problems, drug problems, marital problems, depression, thoughts of suicide. I was 4 out of 5. Because I was single. And I'm sure if I was married, I'd have been batting 1,000. So something made me cut that article out, I stick it on my wallet, and I continued on drinking. So when I was sitting behind the wheel of my car crying, I go over, it's no longer there, but it's one of those old glass of closed phone booths. And I dialed that phone number up. And the woman who answered the phone, I spoke to this lady like I spoke to no one in my life before. I told her the truth. I told her everything was going on in my miserable life. And God bless her, she listened patiently. And she said, listen, why don't you drive over to Hahnemann Hospital? They'll talk to you. I said, okay. And that was like a 5-6 minute drive. I go over. They admit me to their 10th floor, their psychiatric unit. They keep me there 3-4 days, get me kind of stabilized. From there, I get transferred to the VA hospital in West Philadelphia. And I spent about 6 weeks in their flight deck. And from there, I got transferred to the VA hospital out in Coatesville, where I would spend another few weeks in their flight deck before I got put into the alcohol and drug ward. When I pulled over that day and made that phone call, Alcoholics Anonymous was the furthest thing from my mind. Because I didn't have a problem with alcohol, because I was a beer drinker. And you can't be an alcoholic drinking beer. The only time I drank hard liquor was like on St. Paddy's Day or New Year's Day or payday. But I was a beer drinker. And I thought it was my short use of other substances. If I let that crap alone, I'd be okay. Maybe I got this mental illness. I heard this from my mother. Maybe I got this stress disorder. I got this on the job. I got this on the service. Maybe it's the fact that I'm a mummer. Maybe it's the neighborhood I live in. But you can't be an alcoholic. Alcoholics were these poor people I was dealing with on a daily basis. So when I finally got into the drug and alcohol ward, it's the first time in about 8 weeks there's handles on both sides of the door. And it's amazing how quickly the arrogance comes back into a guy like me. So I got to scout the lay of the land. And I wander into the day room. And up in the day room, they had the large window shades of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. And I zipped through those steps. I had about half of them done. The amends, you're screwed. That's not happening. Not my neighborhood. That's a sign of weakness. We won't be doing that. And later that night, two men came up, and I would later find out that they were part of the treatment facility committee. I did not know that then. They came up to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The moment that the speaker said something about his background that I didn't like, couldn't relate to, didn't identify with, I would immediately tune him out. I was too busy listening to the messenger and not the message. And now I'm looking around at my peers in the community and realize that the decision to do something about my drinking was premature. I mean, they're like older dudes, right? They're like in their 30s or 40s. There may have been someone in their 50s. Oh, my God, what am I doing here? These guys, they had wives who hated them, stay away order, support issues. I had none of that, probably due to the fact I never married and didn't have any children. These guys had legal problems. I had no legal problems, probably due to the fact I had a gold shield in my back pocket. These guys had employment issues. I didn't have any employment issues. I've only had one employer. Well, actually, I went from high school to the United States Air Force to the city of Philadelphia. And that's it. So I'm looking for the differences and not the similarities, you know. Maybe it's the short use of other substances, if I left that alone. It can't be alcohol. But what had happened at the end of that first meeting, everyone got in circle and held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. So this is what you're about. And I didn't want nothing to do with you. And I hated God. And there were a lot of good reasons that I hated God, and I just leave it at that, just hated God. And I couldn't respect your right to pray. You know, when I broke away from the group, I would kick the chair, make noise to let you know that I was uncomfortable. But I couldn't even respect your right. And I now know what they said for those who care to join. But I had such a misdirected resentment against organized religion, I couldn't see through that. When I was about to get discharged, the nurse, she had to be a member of Al-Anon. She was just a beautiful lady, and she saw all through my BS. And she came up to me, she says, The only way you're going to make it, you're going to need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I need to tell you, that's the best piece of advice I would get. And that's where I would get my recovery. I got it in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't get it at the VA. The VA did great work, though. They really did. They drained the oil. They tightened the bolts. I mean, they hooked me up. But I would get my recovery in AA. And I went to AA every single day, sometimes 2-3 times a day, depending what tour I was working. I don't drink coffee. I am 62 years old. I've never had a cup of coffee in my life. So I don't make it. Just the way I roll. I don't smoke cigarettes. I've never smoked a cigarette in my life. So I don't empty ashtrays. Not a big deal now. 35 years ago, that was a service position. Big book meeting or step meeting, strictly by accident. I would leave at the break. I had something more important to do. Tradition meetings, are you kidding me? Rules. My line of work, we like to enforce the rules. We don't like to follow the rules. The rules are for other people. I'm not interested in that either. I'm interested in war stories. And the moment that the speaker said something that was bad about his background that I didn't like, couldn't relate to, didn't identify with, I'd immediately tune him out. Too busy listening to the messenger, not the message. But I was a meeting maker. I was crazy as a bedbug. I was just nuts. I remember my first anniversary. I told my story, and it was an amazing experience. Thunderous applause when I got done. The blind could see. The lame could walk. It was truly miraculous. And people came up, and they patted me in the back and said, Bobby, you're doing so good. And I was dying inside because I lied about everything. See, my home group, we could only identify as alcoholic, and I didn't, and I, you know, so I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. In fact, during the course of my story, a bottle of beer appeared in my head, but you guys didn't want to hear that. You want to hear all the quotes, and I'm sure I sound like the second coming of Bill Wilson, you know, but I was dying inside. 23 months sober, I beat another man with a baseball bat. I used to flippantly say, I forget what step I was working that day. But I realized that flippant remark takes away from the viciousness and the ugliness of the incident. 23 months over, making regular tens of meetings, I hit a guy in the head and shoulders 4 times with a baseball bat. My second anniversary came and went. A month after my second anniversary, I went to eat my gun. The same pathetic feeling I had before, but 25 months before, I'm loaded with drugs and alcohol. Here I am, stone cold sober, making regular attendance of meetings in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to eat my gun. Saved the soul. My life was unmanageable. Did I say I didn't have a sponsor? Kind of figured that out, huh? I didn't have a sponsor. I did have one in name only, just in case I was ever questioned. I guess it's got to be my sponsor. I would see him at meetings. He said, yo, I still got that same phone number. I said, yeah, I'll give him a call. I never called him. In fact, you know what I used to do? I used to talk bad about him. I would tell guys, oh, you won't believe this guy. He wants me to do this. He wants me to do that. I made it all up. He put the hand of AA out there. Not only did I slap it away, then I character assassinated the guy. I was nuts. I was just nuts. So I go to this meeting, Friday night meeting. The guy from my neighborhood, whose nickname is Troubles. Everyone in my neighborhood gets a nickname, right? It's just a city thing. Troubles, that's a hard-earned nickname. And he was in and out of jail in the 60s and 70s. In fact, when I first saw him in my first outside meeting, I thought he was either dead or incarcerated. But here he was, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for a few years. But because we were in different lines of work, like I was just not, you know, that's it. Wouldn't talk to him. So I go up to this meeting, and after the meeting, I said, Bobby, because he didn't want to be called trouble, I said, you could tell he was a dude not to be tangled with. You can call him whatever he wants. And he had a lot of ink, but he wore long sleeve shirts. And I never heard him curse, no profanity. I was using the F word as a noun, a verb, and an adjective. But he was, you know, so I go up to him after the meeting. I said, Bobby, I need some help. I said, would you be my sponsor? And he looked me dead in the eye. He said, Bobby, I've been watching you these past couple years, and I'm sticking my chest out. I said, yeah, he kind of likes me. He says, I need to tell you, you're full of shit. That's not the response I'm looking. He said, I will be your sponsor under certain conditions. You're going to call me every single day. You're going to go to a big book meeting. You're going to go to a step meeting. You're going to get yourself a coffee commitment. You're going to go to a men's meeting. You're going to leave them damn women alone. And I'm talking to myself. Who's he talking to? I'm sober 25 months. I'm selling the grapevines. I got it going on. But that's what I did. I nodded, went back to his house that night. It's amazing. I never heard him curse. He must have been saving them for that night, because I went back to his house. Because, you know, my neighborhood was getting gentrified. And you know how that is. The yuppies, they come in, they ruin everything. They take those dilapidated warehouses and make them the loft condos and stuff like that. So the neighborhood was changing, so that was true in AA. So it wasn't as much neighborhood. It was like the newer people. And he knew that I was running circles around those guys. So he would have none of it. And he told me, using some colorful language, and I didn't know anything, I should just shut up and listen. And we went through the first two steps, and then we got on our knees. He said, we're going to get on our knees and say a third step prayer. And I was very uncomfortable with this, but I did it anyway because I was scared. But the truth was, and I was scared of the dude, but the truth was, I also knew that I was safe with this guy. So we said got on our knees, we said the third step prayer, and when we got done, he said, Bobby, the way we do a third step, we pick paper and pen up and do a fourth step. So, whoa, easy does it. Let's keep this simple. How about I just don't drink and go to a meeting? You know, and I know the slogan serve a purpose, but I was twisting around not to do any work at all. But I don't want to do one of these. I'm going to meetings. People say, doing my inventory, stirring stuff up. I feel like going out. I want to stick a gun in my mouth. You can't get no further out than that. So, and I don't have enough time to tell you to go through the rest of the steps, but just in a quick nutshell, I did my fourth step. Now, if I give you the impression I did it in a weekend or a week, that's not true either. It took a couple months. Because when the heat was on, I was eager to do work. And when things were cool, I was cool. You know, it's amazing. The arrogance keeps creeping back. But I did the four. I finally finished it up. So I called them up. I said, Bobby, I'm going to go on a retreat this weekend, do my fifth step with a priest. He said, that's great. When you get done, stop by my house so you can do it with me. And, you know, sometimes you're on your phone with your sponsor and you feel, are you deaf? Did you hear what I said? But I didn't say that. And he said, Bobby, he said, my job, the next two steps, character defects. I need to know what they are in order for me to help you, even though I have a good idea. The reason I want to go do the fifth step with a priest, it wasn't to be spiritually enlightened. I still have the church. I have God on the resentment list. There were a lot of other things on my list that I was afraid to share with him for the fear that he would ridicule me or pass judgment or even worse, betray the confidence and tell others what I was about to disclose to him, which tells you that my fear list wasn't quite done. I never did that fifth step with a priest. I did it with my sponsor, and then they turned out to be unfounded fears. He did none of those things. In fact, what he did, he shared some of his experience with me, which took away the terminal uniqueness in which I thought I was the only person to do certain things. He, too, had taken someone's life, but he went to jail. He paid the debt, and he told me about the incident because, you know, you only hear, like, stories in the neighborhood, right? He told me about the actual incident, and he told me that he was consumed by fear. That's why he carried a gun, you know? He said, I wasn't a tough guy, and, you know, so, and I'll be forever grateful, you know? And then we went through the rest of the steps, and I started to get better, you know, and things started happening. Then I got involved in service, and I learned about the traditions. And I love the traditions now. You know, the traditions are to the group, what the steps are to the individuals, you know. Then I got involved in young people, so I started traveling, you know, it's pretty cool. My first Icky Pop was in Salt Lake City in 1989, and AA had just went to the Soviet Union, and there was a kid there from Russia to read how it works at Saturday night, you know. And just school, just things started happening, man, and life got better. And maybe when life didn't get better, but I got better. So I was 33 years old. At this point, I was sober 6 years sober. I was running about 15 miles about three times a week. You know, I was in probably the best shape of my life. I'm not the most graceful guy. I wear size 13. I trip. I hurt my shoulder. I want the typical alcoholic. I want to run the Boston Marathon. God forbid you just go out for a jog. Now let me do Boston. But to do Boston, you have to qualify. So I was training to do the Marine Corps Marathon, and I tripped and I hurt my shoulder, was throwing my stride off. Let me get this checked out. I got diagnosed with lung cancer. It wasn't the trauma from the fall. It was a tumor pressing against my lung. I never smoked in my life. Never. So it was I went through treatment, you know, and then I bounced back and involved in service. Then I became, I'm the alternate delegate to the area, Area 59. And I wanted to be the youngest delegate ever to the General Service Conference. Who that was, what the age was, I have no idea, but it had to be me, you know, just not. And then I got sick again, and I had a tough time, you know. They eventually, I wound up having surgery where they removed the lower lobe, left lobe, and then I additional surgery where they moved the entire, what was remaining of the left lobe. And but I had people to see, things to do, places to go, you know. But you know what? I couldn't make meetings. Now, we have 1,600 meetings a week in the city of Philadelphia. I love, you know, and at that time, midnight meetings were my favorite. You got to understand midnight meetings. You got people with capes and ray guns. But then you got those who just work second tour and they're coming, you know, it's just, and I couldn't make meetings. And people start coming to my house to carry the message of Equivocs Anonymous. I mean, I'm a liar, thief, and a cheat. I took from anyone, everyone. The only thing I gave was heartache and misery. And people start coming to my house to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm just not talking about my friends or people I knew from the district for the air. I'm talking people that I never met before because they would tag along with someone else. You know? And thank God I had good doctors and a good insurance, but I am a firm believer in the prayer of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? And then things really start happening. I wound up getting stabbed in line of duty pretty severely. And eventually the city put me out on a disability. I went back to grad school, got my MSW, came back with the city, and I started doing counseling in the EAP unit, you know. And it was a great gig, and then I turned 40, and then I turned 50. I said, man, where did the time go? Now, on my 50th birthday, I was in Arizona with a friend of mine, Billy and I were there for the Arizona State Convention, and I had a tough time on my 50th birthday. You know, the book talks about an accurate self-appraisal, but I forgot the accurate part. I'm just doing my inventory and can't compare myself to other people, guys my age, guys I went to school with. I mean, married, you know, 2-3 times, but still with the same wife, some of them, and multiple kids, and some of them grandkids, and I never married. I had no kids, and there's a reason for that. I was a creep with women. I had a real serious issue. I'm about to say this, please. It's not get a joke. It's a God's. It tells you how warped I was. I was sober double digits and got engaged to a married bisexual go-go dancer. That's bizarre. I mean, it's bizarre, you know. And it's, you know, and I always hid behind consenting adults, and that was true. But however, my behavior was still creepy, and I needed to address it. So back up a little bit. So for a long time, Dick Martin was my sponsor, and they had the Cornhusker Roundup, right? So in 2002, I go to Cornhusker, and I meet a young lady, Libby. So I am 42. She is 22. Her parents are 52. They couldn't be any more kinder, and we date. We have this whirlwind romance. Guys are high-fiving me, you know. But at the end of the year, like, I ended it like an idiot. See, I like the long distance. You know why? Because don't need to be intimate from 1,500 miles away. And I had a lot of shortcomings in that area. And I ended it, and I always regretted that, you know. And so then the steps helped, the sponsor helped. But to be honest, I needed some outside help, which I to address this issue. And so long story short, and I would see her because I would go back and see Dick a couple times a year, and I would always see Libby, and she was dating someone, I was dating someone, so it didn't work out. So in 2010, there's a conference called Luck of the Irish. Like, you really can't make this stuff up. And Billy was supposed to speak, but Billy was on the board of General Service, and so it was a board weekend, so he couldn't go, so I went to his place. It was March of 2010, and Libby was the local speaker. Now, I made amends to her, like my side of the street was clean, but I always loved her. I did. And I saw her there, and she just, like, took my breath away. So, but she had a boyfriend at the time. But I need to tell you, her boyfriend was so insecure. And fellas, if you got jealousy, get rid of that, because this is what happened in this guy's situation. He was jealous that I was there. He's going home with her every night. I live 1,500 miles away, so he wouldn't come to the speaker dinner. So I'm flirting with her. Nothing disrespectful, just a little good-natured flirting, right? So later that... it really was. So San Antonio was coming up a couple months later. I said, are you going to the International? She said, no. Nah. She says, too many people. I can't do that. I said, will you come? I have an extra room. You can come. She just looked at me. She says, nah, I don't think so. So that was March. The next month, April, she had called me up and she said, David and I broke up. Yeah. And she said, listen, I need to get out of town. Can I come to Philly this weekend? I said, listen, I'm actually going to be in Orange County this weekend. You know, I'd be more than happy to fly out. We hang out. And she said this. She said, Bobby, no sex. Don't do anything stupid. I need to get out of town. Now, I'm embarrassed to tell you. So this is April of, so I'm 40, yeah. I'm 50 years old. And it's the first time in my life where I actually listened to someone. I could hear the pain in her voice. I said, okay, honey, no problem. We'll just hang out. We went to Orange County. We had a great time. And then we were talking, and then I finally said, listen, I said, I'd like to date you. I said, like, really, like, date you, you know, and I really want to marry you, but not next week, but let's do this right. And we dated, and you know what? We dated for about 10 months before there was any type of physical contact, because we knew how to do that. And again, so in November, we got married in November of 11, yep. Yeah, November 11th, because this coming November will be 12 years. I got married at the age of 51. I love my wife. She's a great AA. She came from a very strong AA community in Philadelphia. She had a tough time when she moved in Philadelphia. She didn't take my last name, and I was cool with that. She's one of them strong women. She would show up to meetings, and people would give her newcomer packets, which used to just burn her, because at this point she's sober 10 years, you know. So, the first year was so difficult. I mean, it was extremely so I tell you, when we got married, it was the Monday before Thanksgiving, November 21st, we got married. The very next day, I flew home by myself because I had my 1 year checkup. And everything came back negative. She drove cross country with her girlfriend and her cat in a U-Haul, you know. And I remember, getting back home. So I flew home Tuesday. Wednesday, I'm at the meeting, and people said, where's your wife? I said, oh, she's driving cross country. And people looked at me and said, what an asshole. But the truth was, it takes a while to get those appointments. So I needed to stick to the appointment. She was good with that. But that first year was difficult. I mean, she had a cat, I had a cat, the cats didn't get along, two strong personalities, she owned her own home, she came to my house, I owned my own home. Now, my house is only 850 square feet, you know, it's a two-bedroom, 14-foot, one-bath house. And I know this is not like on TV, you say small houses, little houses, whatever. That's a house that's like 150 years old. That's the way they made them back in the city back then. But it was tough, and because she didn't have her community, it was difficult. But we got through it. I'm glad I waited as long as I did, because if I would have got married one day sooner, I probably would have blown it, you know. And things were happening, so when she moves to Philly, I'm 51, she's 31. She never wanted to have children. She started hanging out with girls from Philly, and girls her age, she started building up a community, network of girls, you know. She has 8 or 9 girls she's sponsoring. They're all having babies. And then she says, I'd like to have a baby. I said, okay. You reserve the right to change your mind. I was okay with that. Because, listen, I tell people, like, I'm one of 8. You know, 4 of my siblings are grandparents. The Coyle name's getting carried on. So I wasn't concerned with that. But we were unsuccessful. And I think a lot of it had to do with my cancer history and all the chemo and whatnot. So, we go get checked out, and the doctor says, nah, everything's fine. So we eventually resigned ourselves to the fact that we weren't going to have children. And so 3 years ago, I come home from work, and so I tell you, I'm doing the EAP. Then I get involved in union politics. I then become the president of the union representing the municipal employees for the city of Philadelphia. That happened in 15. I got elected to a couple 3-year terms. So I come home from work one day, and Libby tells me she's pregnant.
Yes.
Yeah. I know it's not the Immaculate Reception, and conception, but it's still pretty miraculous. So, but it was pretty cool, and we were excited. So I made a decision at that point. I had like a year and a half left of my term that I was going to run again because I want to be a dad. I want to be active. And I already had like 40 years of service with the city. Like I've maxed out the pension and we were in good shape. I just want to be an active dad. I was looking forward to it. And so we made these life decisions, life making decisions. And then we lost the baby, it was just a difficult time. It was Christmas 3 years ago, and Christmas of 19, and it was tough. And people said, like, were you mad? And we really weren't. I wasn't mad. We were just sad. You know, we were just deeply sad. And it was tough, and it took us a while. Like, we didn't celebrate Christmas for the next 2 years. It was just difficult, you know? But in 2020, you know, like in the midst of our grief, then the world turns upside down and with COVID and then with all the, you know, the nonsense going on in the streets. And again, not to talk politics, but Philly, it just got ugly. And so I just had enough. So I actually retired from my position. I still had a year and a half left of my term. I mean, I just left the position. But when you retire and you have a spouse 20 years younger than you, a week later the union hired me to oversee their EAP, employee assistance, and that's what I do now. And it's pretty neat. So, but then COVID hit, right? And my wife, God bless her, she just, and I had remembered in the 90s when the whole idea about meetings online, and we were concerned about what protections we could have in place. And, you know, and there was a lot of discussion at the area as well as general service. And so, but when COVID hits, you know, everything shuts down and the Zoom meetings pop up. And my wife, of a week into the, and I'm a regular meeting maker. I mean, I go to meetings four or five times a week. And so my wife, she says, Bobby, you going to check out one of them Zoom meetings? That's not AA. Contempt prior to investigation, right? Week later, she came up to me. She said, Bobby, you going to check out one of them Zoom meetings? And I know what she was telling me in her loving way, that I was an asshole. So so I start going to Zoom. A typical alcoholic move. Not only am I Zooming in Philadelphia, middle of the country, West Coast, Ireland, Australia, I'm Zooming all over. I get into it. And I really love to think that Bob and Bill looked down on us when that happened, you know. Because I remember getting sober in the late 80s, you know, there was Loners Internationals, right? If you want to write the people through the General Service Office. Now we got this tool where it's just amazing and it's just really cool. And I always said, well, I don't know if I would have got sober. I actually got a sponsee, took him through the steps. He got sober through Zoom. You know, and so listen, if the pain is great, things will happen. And then we get back to in-person meetings. And I think that pause helped me. I was always an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I believe that's why I was able to get through the tribulations of life without picking up a drink. Because, AA, you know, that's what we promise you. One day at a time. Without picking up a drink, and we can go through anything. And I've seen some men and women go through some terrible things through no fault of their own, and they get through it without picking up a drink, you know? But then, you know, I start getting more re-engaged, and we have a solid group of men at this Wednesday 4:30 meeting, and we do like a Matt Talbot retreat once a year, and I just love it. And my wife even commented, she said, I really can see the change. And at first I was insulted by that. I said, what do you mean? I was always a good AA. But, you know, and I saw that this weekend with you guys. You know, I just think that's special. I really do. So, what's my life like today? I got a life beyond my wildest dreams. So I started a doctoral program almost 7 years ago. And then, but being the president of the union, I just never had the time. I mean, I was working like, you know, 50, 60-hour work weeks, and I didn't think I would get it done. Thank you, Zoom. Thank you, COVID. So when everything shut down, I knock it out online. And you know, a little over about 18 months ago, and I earned my doctorate. So you can go back to your group and you can tell them that you heard Dr. Bob speak. So I told my wife that. I said, honey, I just want you to call Dr. Bob. Call me Dr. Bob once. She said, no problem. She said, honey, Dr. Bob, take the trash out. But I got a life behind my wildest dreams, you know. There's just so much going on. So for a while, I worked in the barrio in North Philadelphia, and I thought I could speak Spanish. My Spanish consisted of dame pistola. It's give me your gun, right? I remember being in Mexico one time, and I thought I was one of the few English-speaking persons, and I tried to share in Spanish, and they're all looking at me, and I switched over to English, and they still didn't understand. But you know what? At the end of the meeting, they came up and they hugged me. And I could tell who the old-timer was by their surrender in their face, and I could tell who the newcomer was by their pain in their face. They may not have understood, but they understood. Language of the heart, you know? I always say these controversial remarks for the end. So if you're new, I don't wish you luck, because luck ain't got nothing to do with it. I hear people say, I went through the steps and I still drank. I must have the misprint edition. When I first got turned on to the big book and I had the fireman's hat on and the concordance and the highlighter, I mean, I would have a 30-minute debate with you whether I was recovering or recovered. And I obviously, by my actions, I was neither. You know, and I would backhand you with the book, you know, because I wanted to make sure the message sunk in. And I was just quoting. I wasn't sharing my experience. But then I got my own experience. And over the years, and people would come up to me. I had one old-timer in our group. He came up to me and said, you know what, Bobby, you got a nice message, but you offend people. It's not what we say. It's the way we say it, you know. And then I had another guy come up, you know, after one of my finger jabbing. He came up and said, if it's so good, why are you so angry? You know, love and tolerance of others is our code, which is now one of my favorite sayings. So I believe strongly in the message of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not going to compromise it for anyone, but I no longer feel the debate with you. If you're interested, that's how I got sober, and that's how I will take you through the steps. And if you're not interested, no harm, no foul. Go along. You know, I work with guys who want it, you know, and, you know, a lot of people need it. But my guys, that's the way we do the steps, and I believe strongly in the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. So how do you stay sober? One day at a time. You get a home group. You get a sponsor. Make sure your sponsor has done the steps. If he or she has not done the steps, he or she has no business sponsoring you. How do you find out they did the steps? I know. You ask them. You were here two things, yes or no. The person says yes, that's your person. I grew up in a neighborhood where very few, you know, a lot of people got, a lot of tradesmen, you know, we had a lot of longshoremen, iron workers. So let's say you want to become an electrician. So you're an apprentice, right? You work the job 4 days a week, you go to school one day a week, and, you know, at the end of 4 years, you become a journeyman. Alcoholics Anonymous is the same thing. We show up, we're an apprentice. We get ourselves a sponsor, a journeyman. He or she takes us under their wings. They share their experience, strength, and hope with us. We become a journeyman. We take an apprentice under our wings. Been working that way since June 10th of 1935. Why do you need a dirt ball from South Philly to come here and tell you to do it any differently? Listen, I'm not the poster boy of Alcoholics Anonymous. I invite you to come live with me for a week. See what type of guy that I am. I know for a fact I'm not the dude that I was 35 years ago. I keep saying 35 years, but that's really just like 11 days away. So I know I'm not the guy that I was 34 years ago. But I like to think I'm not the guy that I was 3 years ago. And if I am, shame on me. Making mistakes, that's okay. Making mistakes doesn't get me loaded. It's defending those mistakes or justifying those mistakes or not learning from those mistakes. That's what leads to the arrogance, and that's what leads to the drink, you know. I love being sober. I love being an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love being married. I love God. I love everything today. And I'll finish up with this. So we had a personal tragedy back in November. A very dear friend of ours, sober woman of Alcoholics Anonymous, 41 years old. Her and her 15-year-old daughters, twin daughters, were killed in an automobile accident. And her husband, who was also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, lost his entire family in a flash. And he got through that, and he's handled himself with dignity and grace, you know. But this is what, so we went to the funeral, and the priest was, gave such a beautiful message. And I remember calling Bob and telling him about it. And Bob told me, it's just like in AA. Like, sometimes we show up, it's the messenger. And this was a young guy, and so just, it's just the way he carried himself. And I thought that I did a lot of work. I no longer had resentment towards the church. And I really believe I didn't. But there must have been something there. But it all melted away. I talked to the guy afterwards. So in January, right after New Year's, my wife and I went to Italy. We were in Rome for a week. And then we went to Florence. And Rome has 900 churches. I think I covered all of them. But I actually had a spiritual experience. Not the white flash experience. But I just had a spiritual experience. And I remember getting done, you know, having this experience in this church, I just walked away lighter. So that's a great thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, always learning. And I love learning, especially if someone else is going to pay for the education, I'll go to school for the rest of my life. So I thank you guys for inviting me to participate. I thank you for the committee. I used to be involved in a conference back in Philadelphia, so I understand the work that the committee does. So thank you for that. And I guess that's it. That's all I got.